Forecast, cloudy and mild, rain likely off and on today, a high of 73. Looking at the current radar, there is a big storm system now heading directly towards us. It's now moving out of Dubuque in our direction, probably after 9:30, maybe closer to 10 o'clock. We'll have some rain. Current numbers, wind southeast at 12, humidity 68%, 70 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg. Next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That stirring music is by Richard Wagner. It is from his opera Lohengrin. And this happens to be a recording made back in 1950 by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, led by conductor Fritz Reiner. We put on a compact disc, or we press a button on Spotify or Apple Music and listen to whatever strikes our fancy in that moment, and do not give a second thought to the wonder of recorded sound. But one comes away with a deeper appreciation for this miracle, this man-made miracle, after reading an incredibly fascinating book titled Into the Groove, The Story of Sound from Tin Foil to Vinyl. The author of the book, Jonathan Scott, a music writer with a voracious interest in recordings of all kinds, including recorded oddities from over the years, has set down in this fascinating book the story of how human beings developed the technology of being able to record sound. And he stretches that history back even before the time of Thomas Edison, who is commonly and rightfully called the inventor of the phonograph. But Jonathan Scott points to some who came before him who, in a sense, helped pave the way. And he takes that history then into the development of early recordings and ultimately 78s and ultimately into the long playing record. And it is a history far more complicated than any of us would ever imagine. And I so appreciate the way in which he has written this history with such clarity and with a true sense of delight. The book is published by Bloomsbury Sigma, again titled Into the Groove, The Story of Sound from Tin Foil to Vinyl. And Jonathan Scott, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on.
I'm delighted to speak with you. I should mention that you are speaking to me from far off Great Britain, but thanks to this invention called the telephone, we can have this conversation. And I appreciate you making time for this discussion of your fascinating book. Tell us first a little bit about your own personal interest in recordings, and if you can trace that to anything in particular.
The first time I remember putting on records was, I remember hassling my parents and just saying, please, can we listen to this? And I remember we had a very powerful amplifier, and I wasn't allowed to touch the record player, you know, like a lot of under fives. You know, they don't mix well with vinyl. So my parents would put on a record, and I just remember it was so loud, and the crackle as they used to slightly scare me, frankly. But I just remember being just sort of, I just couldn't quite understand how a disc of bumpy plastic could make such amazing sounds. And And in a sense, that's exactly what, that was the starting point for this book in many ways, in that sometimes I still collect records now, and I still sometimes put on records and I kind of get that sort of memory of what it's like to listen to a record for the first time, and to sort of just the wonder of this incredible invention, because we all take it for granted. You sort of said this in your very, very nice introduction, thank you, but we all take music for granted. And the whole point of the book was really to try and strip some of that away and revel in just how lucky we are to have music and sound totally at our control.
Hmm. I'd love to have you relay to our listeners a brief little story from the foreword of the book. It's essentially how the book begins, and it is one Thomas Edison showing a visitor around his laboratory in Menlo Park, New Jersey. Describe your listeners as best you can this particular visit and in a sense how your account of this visit ends. It's a beautiful segue into the book that follows.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, Edison was known. He was the kind of man that didn't suffer fools gladly. But if he thought, he loved engineers and scientists and people who he felt got it, so to speak. And one day, it was in the late 1870s, he was showing a journalist around. He regularly had journalists, and he was very good at generating column inches. And he was showing the visitor around, explaining how sound worked, how it was possible to record and reproduce sound. And the journalist kept going, oh, yes, and nodding his head and making notes. And Edison was sort of quite pleased. He's like, oh, yes, this man really gets it. And then the man sort of just said, yeah, that's all good. I just have one question. I understand it all, except how the sound gets out again. And Edison was just, his face fell. And, you know, and this, the thing about that is that in a way, summarizes me. And I totally, yes, I understand that a plastic record is essentially a transducer, you know, that turns mechanical energy into electrical energy. I understand all that, but I still don't really understand all that. Right. That's the thing. I still look at them and go, really? No, surely that shouldn't work.
Right. It's like you can know a lot about it and yet, in a sense, not fully grasp it. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, there are parallels with lots of the lovely inventions that we all take for granted. Electricity. We all understand what electricity is, but it's still pretty amazing.
Absolutely. You write, the reason I love records, the thing that inspired me to write this book is that I don't understand them either. I remain as delighted and mystified by them as when I was 5 years old. And I want to give you a chance to also talk about what you go on to kind of describe, and you kind of touched on this briefly as you first began speaking, about what it was like for a record to be played in your home. And you go on then to contrast that with the way in which most of us now typically listen to music in the early 21st century.
Yeah, and I think this is at the heart of what's so special about records, because, yes, back in the day, I remember the sort of the warm crackling sound as the amplifier sort of warmed up. I remember the sort of bassy rumble as the needle skipped across the groove. And I remember the sort of frightening sound as well as it skipped on the run-out groove after the music had finally stopped. But the point is, it's a lovely process. It takes time. You have to click the buttons, get the tone arm in the right place, take the vinyl out carefully, place it on it. You know, and it's a lovely feeling. Now, I can... So there's a record I was searching for years in the 1990s, and I can find it in a second now on Apple or Spotify, as you say. And it's not to say that the record is better as such, but it's you communing with music in a different way. A record is for when you have time to listen to music in the full sense of listening to music. It's not for when you're going on a run or doing the dishes or driving. And it's wonderful that we can listen to music while doing all these things. Of course it is. But records have a special place in the heart of a lot of listeners because they are for that moment you give yourself. Mm. You know, that special moment where it's just, okay, I'm going to put this song on, but I'm going to put it on properly. I'm going to put the record on.
Exactly. I want to read one portion of your foreword, if you don't mind. You write this. There are easier ways to listen to music. I can type the title of a record into Apple Music or Spotify that took me years to track down in the mid-1990s. A few taps later, I'm listening to it again, and I've barely moved. There's nothing wrong with that, of course, but it's just different. With records, the process is slow and delightful. The switches, buttons, and knobs, the volume and tone controls, the little red light, the soft hum, the selection of the record, the removal from the sleeve, the careful placing on the turntable, speed select, click, spin. Vinyl is the format for when you have the time and will to engage with music in a deeper way. It's the format for when you're ready to immerse yourself, to kneel at the altar and just listen. It's not for when you're doing the dishes or rushing to the shops or stripping wallpaper or writing a book. Vinyl is for you. It's the moment that you give yourself a trip to the Cathedral of Sound. I really applaud you for all those beautiful turns of phrase and for really summing up something that most of us are just not taking the time to fully consider and appreciate.
Oh, well, thank you. Honestly, it's really lovely hearing someone read it back to me. I don't suppose you want to do my audio book, because that was really nice. thank you very much. I mean, that encapsulates how I feel about the whole subject. In terms of how I originally started on this road, it was actually partly because my previous book is called The Vinyl Frontier. That was all about the Voyager Golden Record, the strange NASA record that they stuck to the side of the Voyager space probes. And that was launched in 1977. And in the aftermath of that book, I was just sort of, much was made at the time it went in 1977, 100 years after Edison had invented the phonograph. And I think that's it. I couldn't bear to let the story of the Golden Record go. So I just became kind of interested in the prequel to the Golden Record, telling the story of how it came about originally. And that, and in many ways, that was the sort of starting point. I'm able to let go of the story I'd enjoyed so much.
Right. And I think now I better understand why chapter one of your book is titled The End, because you are talking about interesting events in the year 1977, including the launch of that so-called Golden Record, but also an honor bestowed on somebody whose name will be completely unknown to just about any American, but somebody who figures prominently in this century-plus story that you tell of Into the Groove. Tell us what was happening at the White House in November of 1977 and who then President Jimmy Carter was greeting and honoring.
He was honoring Dr. Peter Goldmark, who was a Hungarian-born engineer, really, but he was basically President Carter was giving a whole load of scientists. They were essentially getting a sort of medal for services to science, and Dr. Goldmark was there specifically for the invention of the LP, i.e. the vinyl record, which was first launched in 1948. And, the president sort of went off script. But there were people there for all sorts of, scientific inventions. But when Peter Goldmark was introduced, President Carter sort of went off script and went, "Oh, I'm particularly grateful to you for your invention," and gave him a sort of backslap. Because, back then, of course, that was when vinyl was the king. It was the dominant format in 1977. So, it's just a rather nice moment. It felt like, that the man who really helped launch vinyl upon the world was thanked by President Carter. It just seemed a nice place to start. But of course, it's also tinged with sadness because only 2 weeks after that, Peter Goldmark actually died in an automobile accident. And so is it sort of a somber thought as well that this all happened in the same year? I mean, 1977 was such a... So many things seemed to happen in that year. You know, that was the year of peak vinyl sales in America. That was the year that Rumours by... I've forgotten who made Rumours. You know who made Rumours. A mental block because I'm thinking of other things that came out in 1977. Come on, who made Rumours? Fleetwood Mac. Thank God. Fleetwood Mac made Rumours, and Meatloaf made Bad Out of Hell. It was the year of punk. You know, there was just so much going on in 1977. And that's why it just seemed such... It seemed a really interesting date to start the story and then rewind 100 years. But as you say, I actually ended up going further back in time because I felt that... truly tell the story of how records were first made, how the groove first came into being, you kind of had to back up a little further to talk about how human beings learned to understand and experiment with sound.
We're speaking with Jonathan Scott, and we're talking about his brand new book called Into the Groove, The Story of Sound from Tinfoil to Vinyl. The story is essentially a century-long story dating more officially from Thomas Edison's invention of the phonograph in 1877 to the year 1977. But as we were just saying, it is a history that stretches even further back than Edison's invention. One thing you touch on early in the book is that when it comes to saying that so-and-so invented such-and-such, that that can be a really tricky matter. That, first of all, almost nobody invents something entirely on their own. Almost always, somebody is building on the work of others who came before them. And it can be very tricky sometimes to talk about an invention and its inventor in a way in which you're being fair to everybody and fair to that inventor, but fair to those who came before, without diminishing the significance of that moment of invention or final breakthrough. I really appreciate you taking a moment to kind of talk about the complexity of that and tell us how that is especially true when it comes to somebody like Thomas Alva Edison and the phonograph.
Yeah, you're right. It's a really interesting subject. And, I mean, the birth of the phonograph took place when Thomas Edison and his crack team of engineers were experimenting with new forms of telegraph, a kind of a way of taking messages by telegraph by perforating essentially paper with Morse code and then being able to play that message back. And they were also experimenting with telephones. The telephone had been invented the year before, 1876, Alexander Graham Bell. And that gives us another example. That's a famous one where a number of scientists were working on very similar technology, but it was Alexander Graham Bell who got to the patent office first, shall we say. And a similar thing happens in the phonograph. And in fact, when Edison's invention finally became global news at the end of 1877, people like Alexander Graham Bell were quite... You know, we're like, oh, we were so close. How did we not think of that? And that's the thing that, well, because they had so many brilliant minds working in similar areas. I think it's true to say that even if Edison had been, say, struck by lightning at the beginning of 1877, someone else would have come up with similar technology at around the same time. For example, there's a Frenchman called Charles Cros, who I mentioned in the book, a lovely-sounding Parisian man who drank a bit too much absinthe and died rather young. But he came up with a perfectly workable scientific method for recording and reproducing sound in April of 1877, but he didn't have the funds to make it happen, whereas Edison, by 1877, had been successful enough that he surrounded himself with brilliant engineers and also had the money and reputation to see it through. Plus, Edison, in all of his inventions, they didn't always work. Not all his inventions were good, but he was absolutely obsessed with a couple of things, which was utility and profitability. And that sort of obsession is what, in ways, marked him out from other inventors who might just allow themselves. He might be sort of too distracted by dreaming what they could do. He always wanted it to actually work, to actually be useful.
Right. I think you say it so well at one point in this chapter when you say an idea without development can end up being useless. And yeah. I think what you're saying is that Thomas Alva Edison was not only a person with ideas and able to build on the ideas of others, but he also had a real flair for creating the useful. I mean, and you know, the word useful, that might seem like kind of an unremarkable, kind of a mundane sort of term, but that's really when the magic happens, when an idea becomes something that is useful in our lives. I mean, that's when something really changes the world.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing. I didn't go into the book, into the research, wanting to necessarily delve into the life of Thomas Edison. But the more I read about him, the more he's got a reputation for a reason. And he's just an incredible workaholic who just had such drive for getting to a useful end result in all the things he made. Again, I stress, they weren't always successful. But the actual point of eureka, as it were, is from July 1877, when he was working on a new type of telephone. They'd been given quite a lot of money to come up with a non-infringing version of the telephone, so they could, you know, make some money off this new invention without, you know, getting sued. And he had a diaphragm in his hand and was sort of singing into it, a telephone diaphragm, and was just singing into it, or speaking into it, some people say, and feeling the way it vibrated against the palm of his hand. And he turned to his chief engineer and just said, who was called Charles Batchelor, and he said, Charles, well, he actually called him Batch, if we got a point on this diaphragm and then could pull some kind of recording material beneath it as we spoke, if we pulled it back again afterwards, we'd get our speech back. And that was the starting point. And that very day, they rigged up a very basic, what sound historians call it, a strip phonograph, which is essentially a mouthpiece with a diaphragm and a spike. And beneath it, you pull paraffin paper, which is paper covered in essentially wax. And in July 18th, that very day, he recorded in his laboratory notes how he had just tried this experiment. And he wrote, the speaking vibrations are indented nicely, and there's no doubt I shall be able to store up and reproduce automatically at any future time the human voice perfectly. So that was the starting point. Of course, by the end of the year, the invention had changed. It was no longer this sort of a strip phonograph design. It had become the cylindrical tin foil, as it's known, phonograph that became the thing that was launched on the world and changed the world.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jonathan Scott about his book, Into the Groove, The Story of Sound from Tin Foil to Vinyl. Although Thomas Alva Edison indeed is properly credited as the inventor of the phonograph, as we've already touched on, there were people who came before him. And I really appreciate the fact that your book does not rush through some of these other aspects of the history of recorded sound. And what shocked me was that your exploration of this goes all the way back to Galileo, so centuries before Edison. But it's important for us to understand that there were people, even as early as Galileo, who were intrigued by the nature of sound itself. And I'm sure I never, until I read your book, stopped to think about how that would be one area of scientific exploration. I mean, that people would be wondering that long ago, what is sound? and of course, without that curiosity in and of itself, you don't end up with Mr. Edison and the phonograph.
No, exactly. And it was the interest in studying sound just for the sake of it that led to, one of the key inventions in the story is the phonautograph from 1857, which was invented by a Parisian bookseller. And essentially, long story short, the way this worked, it looks a bit like an early phonograph, and it's just for recording sound, and it would trace the sound. You spoke into it, and it would trace the sound by tracing recording a line on lamp-blacked paper. So it, essentially in sort of soot, you might say. And the stylus was actually a boar's bristle in his very early version of his invention. But the point is, it created just these strips of paper that he called phonautograms. And he never thought of reproducing that sound. He just felt that if you could study the wavy lines that it traced in the lamp black paper, you could almost learn to read it. This is what he hoped, that it would in some way, it could become a new kind of natural writing, if you see what I mean. Like you could say, hello, my name is, and it would make a recognizable shape, and with practice and learning, you could learn to read sound waves. Now, of course, that isn't possible, but it was still the first time that airborne sounds had been captured and recorded, even though there was no way of playing them back.
Right. And of course, the thing is, you could look at this. I mean, it was visible to the naked eye, and you could tell by having said something in a certain pattern, it would look like whatever, and then you would say something or sing something completely different, and the pattern would be completely different. So even without having heard it played back, because that was impossible, you still knew that somehow the sound I have just created has been recorded on this strip of paper. Because at first, as I'm reading, I feel, well, how would you even know that you've recorded the sound if you can't listen back to it? But just looking at it, the visual record of it, in a sense, was all the proof you needed to know that you, in fact, had recorded that particular unique sound in that moment.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's partly because he was a printer and bookseller, and printing back then was an incredibly difficult job. And I think that's possibly why he became so obsessed with the idea of reading sound, because I think it would have been the ultimate labor-saving device if it had been, rather than doing all this writing and typeface and all the complicated stuff that a printer had to do back then, you could just say something and it was, you know, immediately readable on a piece of paper. You know, that's quite a seductive thought. But it never did, but it's still, I'm glad to say, it's still remembered as a really important step. And another thing that listeners may have heard about was, although the sounds at the time were never heard, in 2008, the First Sounds Collective, basically a bunch of brilliant American scientists, managed to reconstruct the sound from one of these phonautograms. And it's absolutely haunting. You can go onto the website firstsounds.org and listen to a whole load of these recordings that they've managed to reconstruct by essentially doing, it's not as simple as this sounds, but essentially doing a kind of detailed 3D scan of these trace sound waves. And you can hear the sound of what they think is Edouard Leon Scott de Martinville himself, the inventor of the phonograph, him singing in 1860. So that's right. Full 17 years before Edison's invention of the phonograph.
And here is one of those recordings, or at least a few moments of it. Here it is. Just a few seconds of that, and I think from the sounds of it, this might be an earlier version, because one of the things you tell us in the book is that one of the trickiest things was not having any idea of at what speed these recordings should be played back, and it took a long time for them to kind of figure out just at what speed to replay these old phonautograms.
Yeah, that's right. And that was the first time they thought that was correct, and they thought it was a woman singing, but in fact they did a second version, you're totally right, where they realized it had been recorded slower, and it's a man's voice doing it.
And most likely the inventor.
it's still, you know, it's putting your ear to 1860, which is just a mind-blowing thought.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. Shortly thereafter in the book, this, what we've just been talking about, the first known instance of actual recorded sound is in Chapter 2 called The Beginning. Chapter 3 is called Oddballs. And this is where the story becomes, in some respects, even more fascinating, and for me at least, even more unexpected. Some of this I had no idea had existed, or certainly had no sense that any of this tied into the kind of the mainstream story of the development of the phonograph. Explain to our listeners the sort of characters and the sort of intriguing developments that we find in your chapter titled Oddballs.
Well, yes, you could argue this was a bit of a digression. And essentially it's a summary of various ingenious but rather strange characters who tried to create a talking machine, tried to create machines that could make realistic human sounds. And there's some really strange characters. I mean, there was one particular one called Kemplin, who wrote the mechanism of human speech with a description of a speaking machine. That was in the 1760s. And that, although was not necessarily the most realistic sound ever, but the point is it inspired a whole load of other, I think you'd call them rather strange experimental tinkerers to have their own go at making one, and possibly the most successful one was made by a rather strange solitary character called Joseph Faber. He was born in 1800 in Austria, and he was in his 20s when he got hold of Kempler's book and just basically caught this bug to create a human-like machine. And he absolutely dedicated his life to it. He spent decades doing it. He made one, was rather annoyed that it didn't get much, it didn't generate much interest, so he destroyed it. Then he made another, again, that kind of repeated. By this time, he came to New York City, and it didn't make much of an impact, so he destroyed that too. Then in 1845, he was in Philadelphia with a new version, and this was like, so 2 decades of trial and error making this strange machine, which involved him sort of standing at a keyboard, operating a whole load of levers and keys, and using bellows. And he could basically, with lots of practice, he could get this strange machine to speak. And he'd given it a sort of face as well, and you can see a photograph of it, because one fan of the whole thing was Barnum. And Barnum put in, T.T. Barnum got wind of it and put the euphonia, on permanent display in London and then later in America as well. And but the thing is, it was uncanny. It was rather strange. It was quite slow and mournful. I imagine it sounding a bit like a sort of, like Eeyore, from the Pooh Bear books. But in a sense, it's just, the reason I find it was connected with the story is that, for a start, when the first record players, when Edison's phonograph first came along, it was described in the popular press as a talking machine, because that's what it was. It was a machine that could talk. And so for me, part of the history or prehistory of the talking machines were these really strange earlier talking machines where it wasn't trying to record sound, it was just trying to create sound, to imitate human voices. And the other reason I found it of interest is that Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, also tried his hand at one of these strange inventions when he was just a teenager with his brother Melville living in, they lived in Edinburgh at the time, and they tried their hands at creating, they were inspired and tried to create their own, strange voice creators, and they made a wooden tongue with like 3 moving parts and rubber cheeks and a tin sort of voice box, and it doesn't sound like it did sound particularly well, but they could get it to say mama, and apparently used to manage to sort of startle some neighbours in the building where they lived in Edinburgh. So it's a very strange part of the story, But as I say, it all, for me, connects in with talking machines. The first wave generation of phonograph users, record players, called them talking machines because they were machines that could talk. And in fact, if you read a lot of the newspaper reports of Edison's invention, there's almost a sense of disappointment at how simple his invention seems. Because it's a talking machine, people are expecting it to have, you know, steam and all kinds of buttons and cogs and complicated things like that. But actually, it looks like a lathe. You know, it's just a really simple thing that you turn and cover in tinfoil. And but yeah, I mean, honestly, it was such a fun part of the story to delve into because it is so strange.
Absolutely. You know, one way to think of it would be it's like a cuckoo clock. You know, that little bird comes out of the door. And, you know, that's not the recorded sound of an actual bird. It's something created to imitate the sound of a bird. And this was a machine, in a sense, constructed to imitate the sound of people talking. And, of course, now we can only wonder what exactly it sounded like. But I am so glad that you include this in your book. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jonathan Scott. We're talking about his book, Into the Groove, The Story of Sound, From Tinfoil to Vinyl. You, of course, spend plenty of time talking about Thomas Alva Edison and how he manages to ultimately create the phonograph. One of the things you tell us about his background is that he worked for many, many years in the telegraph industry. And became, you say, part of a nomadic community of skilled telegraph operators who would take short-term positions in offices across the country. And for a long time, he was really anxious to make telegraphs work better. And it sounds like that is a connection to the development of the phonograph. I mean, there's a closer relationship there than we might actually realize.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as well, some versions of the origin story of the phonograph, because as you can imagine with any sort of historical event, there are slight variations in the story. But some versions of the story get him, his original invention being, his original eureka not being caused by the telephone diaphragm on the hand, as I described earlier, but actually being one of his telegraph machines. He was working on a machine specifically at that time that could take in a message, a Morse code message, imprint it on paper, and then be made to reproduce it later or play it back at different speeds. In fact, one of the inventions he was working on literally looks almost like a pair of record decks. It's fascinating, but just by a strange coincidence. But this is, and anyway, what was I saying? The eureka moment was that he just was listening to the sound of the perforating needle against the paper, and it reminded him of speech. And some versions have that being the eureka moment, if you see what I mean. Including, actually, there was a film in the 1940s starring Spencer Tracy as Edison called Edison the Man, a very great title. And in that, the eureka moment is, in movie land, is that one. It's him, he sees a machine, he listens to the strange noise it's making, and it reminds him of human speech, and he comes up with the phonograph.
Hmm. And you've mentioned Mr. Batchelor, I think, or a name sort of like that. That was one of his assistants. Yes, that when years later, when he was interviewed about kind of all of this coming about, I remember him quoted in your book as saying something like, "We really didn't know what all of this even meant." I mean, even they hands-on creating this at certain points did not understand maybe or fully appreciate the immensity of the discovery that they were bringing about with their efforts.
Definitely, and I think there's a strong they really didn't, and there was also a sense in the laboratory of a slight lack of surprise at that first eureka moment as well, when the strip phonograph that I described earlier worked. There was a kind of general feeling of, oh yeah, that should work. Oh yeah, it does work. Well, onward, you know. And they didn't really know what to do with it. And I think it was actually the enthusiasm of certain outsiders and the reaction, because it was announced to the world in the magazine Scientific American, first as a letter and then as a more in-depth article, both towards the end of 1877. And in that, you really get a sense of the excitement that people have. And like, you know, it really, it becomes like the equivalent of photography was for light. The phonograph becomes for sound. And the way they write about it is that they talk about how the great excitement was you'll be able to record your loved ones. Mm. You'll be able to record people's voices, and then after they're gone, just as a photograph, you can see them after they're gone, so with the phonograph, you'll be able to listen to their voices after they're gone.
Right.
And that wasn't, it wasn't like all the marketing, all the coverage was around that, but that was the sort of emotional part of the coverage of the invention.
You quote Edward Johnson writing this, the new invention will create the profoundest of sensations and liveliest of emotions as it allows humans to once more hear the familiar voices of the dead. In fact, you a little later in the book give us a list that Mr. Edison created of 10 potential uses for the phonograph. And what is so striking about that list is that music, reproducing and replaying music, is number 4. That there are all these other potential uses for the phonograph that we have a sense were much more important to Mr. Edison and, of course, have, in a sense, fallen away. I mean, now we think of the phonograph as first and foremost about recording and replaying music. But Edison seems to have really been interested in other possibilities ahead of that.
Definitely. And there are a few things to say about that. I mean, one thing is that he was, as I said before, so focused on it being profitable and being useful. So he was trying to market the phonograph as an aid to business. And he carried on doing this for years. Even after the music business had taken off, he was still marketing a version of the phonograph aimed at business, where he imagined someone in an office could dictate a letter into a phonograph, and then someone could type it up at a later date. Or you could actually just send the phonograph. And that, it, you know, people did use it for that. You know, that did work. And for him, he wanted that to be the focus of business. He did like music. He wasn't that interested in music, but he did like music. But yes, that's partly why it's down on the list, because he felt music was a sort of one of the more frivolous reasons. Hmm. And he saw most profit in it as an office aid, a labor-saving device.
Right.
Also, if you listen to the very earliest sounds of either someone recreating or the very rare early tinfoil records that survive, the earliest one is actually from 1878, you can see why music is quite low down on the list. Because obviously back then, the sound quality in that first phonograph was terrible.
Right, absolutely. And there are all kinds of things that made it a great limitation. that's for sure. In fact, I'm reminded of one of the most precious mementos that exist from this really early period, and that is the one and only recording in which we hear first the spoken voice of the great Johannes Brahms, and then Brahms playing one of his piano works, but he sounds like he's standing under a waterfall. I mean, we can scarcely make out the sound. Let's just hear a few moments of this Edison cylinder with Brahms himself. And of course, that cylinder might have sounded much better back in 1889 than it does now. But nevertheless, of course, there were limitations and other limitations, technically speaking, that kept the phonograph from taking off as Edison had hoped. And your book tells us that Edison actually tilted away from the phonograph towards the light bulb. I mean, he really lost interest. And into the void, into that vacuum, steps Alexander Graham Bell and his Volta laboratory to try to advance this new technology. Tell us briefly about Mr. Bell and the Volta laboratory and why this is such an important chapter in the story.
Well, you're totally right. Yeah, the original tinfoil phonograph was a wonder of the age, but it wasn't immediately very useful. So it didn't fade into obscurity, but not much was done with it, and he was more profitably engaged with inventing the light bulb. So it just sort of went into a slight lull. And as I mentioned earlier, Alexander Graham Bell later, you know, wrote about how he was actually quite frustrated that he hadn't come up with the phonograph. He just felt it was such an obvious step. So in the 1880s, he and some associates formed what was known as the Volta Lab, Volta Associates, they called themselves, in Washington, D.C., they based themselves. And this is in ways one of my favorite periods of the story. It's big, they basically, for several years, experimented with almost every conceivable method for recording sound onto objects. They experimented with disc-shaped records, with cylindrical-shaped records. One of the first things they did, actually, was take one of Edison's own phonographs, the original phonograph, and simply cover it with wax and then see how well that worked. But, and the other, so it's such a fascinating story because they tried so many strange things. They tried recording using magnetism. They tried recording using light and in photographic emulsions. And if you go, this is another thing I really recommend listeners to do, but again, you could go to firstsounds.org or go to the Library of Congress website because you can listen to some of these very experimental recordings, and they're absolutely fascinating. They're on card, wax, brass, glass, and they're so strange. Like this wonderful one, which is just someone going, bah, raw, me, ta, over and over again.
And here it is. The word barometer over and over again. And here's another in which we hear someone doing lip trills and counting. There's something almost playful about that, and we have this sense of amazing discovery in the moment. I mean, it is like we are back in time in a way that is absolutely thrilling.
I couldn't agree more.
Yes.
I became slightly obsessed with Volta. some of these ways of recording were so experimental that they couldn't even play them back, so it's quite likely that some of those sounds they never heard again. So it's literally like we're just putting our ear to their laboratory door and listening to them and all their strange experiments.
Right, and the spark of discovery, the joy in the moment, it's just amazing. It is a visceral thrill to be taken back like that. Well, of course, Mr. Edison re-enters the fray, and your book also recounts how he felt that this was not a toy. He was resistant to certain possibilities in terms of how it would be used. Should it be a coin-operated machine in amusement parks or whatever? Ultimately, of course, it finds its way into many homes. And thanks to the developments of others from other places, including one Mr. Emil Berliner, the technology advances in spectacular ways, and it changes everything. And ultimately, your book goes on to tell us about the development of the 78 and ultimately the long playing record. It's an incredible story. At the outset, did you realize what a fascinating story this would be to explore?
No, I wouldn't say I did. I think though, actually, it was sort of getting into the Volta story that sort of really excited me. But I also, I felt so lucky because I visited the Library of Congress and met some amazing people there and saw some of these incredibly rare, strange discs. And as well, it's such a wonderful time to be interested in early sound, because if I tried to write this book 30 years ago, it would have been so much harder. But now, thanks to the work of some brilliant people, you can go and listen to you can literally go and listen to so much music from the 1890s, which was a really fascinating period as the music business took off, you know, and sound engineers became more and more skilled at recording sound and you can just go and listen to them right now, and it's just so inspiring to be able to listen to some of these things in a way that just if I'd only been able to read about them, it would not have been the same. So I feel very lucky to have that at my fingertips.
Right. Well, I feel lucky to have been able to read your fascinating and wonderful and entertaining book, Into the Groove, The Story of Sound from Tinfoil to Vinyl, published by Bloomsbury Sigma. We have just scratched the surface. Jonathan Scott, the author. Jonathan Scott, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. What a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.